Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Ray, and welcome to the RayWenderlich.com podcast. In this podcast, we'll keep you up to date with the latest app development tech talk. Now, here are your hosts, Mick and Jake.
Welcome back to the RayWenderlich.com podcast. In this episode, we're going to be talking about React Native with Nick Lockwood from Facebook. But before we get onto that, Jake, there is a couple of things that I wanted to talk to you about. So the first one, and this has been a long time coming, is that Apple finally opened the doors for app analytics in iTunes Connect. Has it been worth the wait and, you know, with the kind of insight that it gives you?
Well, yes and no. So I have a couple of apps. They're not huge. They're small. You know, I have maybe, 50 downloads a day or something like that. And so the first thing I noticed was all of the App Store stuff. So it'll tell you how many views your App Store page is getting, which is huge. There's been no way to get that information up till now. So you could tweak your, App Store search term optimization. And the only way you would know if it had an effect was if it actually trickled through to actual downloads. And, if you're doing any kind of promotion, it's hard to know that funnel, like how many people are looking at my App Store page versus how many people are actually purchasing. So that was a big deal. And that's really, really nice to have. So And then there's also this new campaign link that you can create. So if you want to do an advertising campaign or something, you can create a specific link for that ad campaign. And then anybody that clicks through from that ad, you're going to be able to track, App Store views and actual conversions then from a particular channel, which again is huge. And there have been services, third-party services, that have tried in the past to create ways to get that information. But I've tried to use some of them, but I've never had anything that was really useful or worked or I was happy with. So from that point of view, very, very happy with app analytics. But a couple of the downsides, it's opt-in. So it does give you like session information, but only people that, and we've probably all noticed this when you install a new app, it prompts you and says, do you want to let, developers have this information about you? And a lot of people are saying no. According to Apple, only 18% are opting into that analytics.
Is that 18% specific to your app, or is that 18% across the whole of iOS?
That's global. So wow. And you don't know, they don't tell you for your app what it is. That's in their FAQ. Yeah, so that's low, right?
That's crazy low, that.
I guess it makes some sense, but yeah, I was surprised that it was that low. I would have expected at least half to opt in.
So have you used other analytics providers then before now?
Yes. Yeah, so I use Flurry in one of my main apps, and I have for forever.
So how would you compare Apple's analytics to Flurry then? Like, are you getting type of information? Is it just a subset?
Yeah, so I mean, one thing I did do was look, I created a spreadsheet where I pulled in what I was getting from Apple and what I was getting from Flurry. And obviously the numbers in Flurry were much bigger because it represents everybody, not just iOS 8. So App Analytics is only active on devices that are running iOS 8 first. And then obviously only, 18% of those people. So it was a small chunk. Flurry gives you way more ways to cut into the information, like way more views and different like filters and stuff. So App Analytics is still kind of a basic feature set. I mean, it's definitely a 1.0 in terms of what you can do on how to slice up your data and look at it. And all the major stuff you'd want to know is there, just for the subset of your audience. And then the other interesting thing I noticed was that the numbers I'm getting from, I use App Figures, which is just pulling from iTunes Connect the sales data. So the sales data coming from iTunes Connect that I'm looking at in App Figures and the sales data that I'm looking at in App Analytics is not exactly the same. So I'll have like a big day in one view, and then in the other, it's like the next day or like 3 days later is a big day. So I didn't know what was going on there. That was a little strange.
This has been in works, well, for well over a year, because I assume they were working on it before they announced it, but they officially announced this at WWDC last year.
Yeah.
And it's almost,
yeah, no, it's WWDC, we've been waiting for it for, yeah, forever, right? Like a really long time.
So is there at least a year's worth of data?
No, so that's a good point. I should have mentioned that. It's only April. We only got the last 30 days.
Wow. So it's a subset of 18% of just the last 30 days.
Yes. Okay. And that was weird to me too, because I'm like, why? Clearly they've been gathering, it's clearly the code's been in place on the client side to gathering this data for much longer than April. I was thrilled with it in that the two big things that I've always really needed to know that there's just been no way to figure out, which is how many people look at my App Store page, and of them, how many buy. That's been a black box, and there's been no third-party way to figure it out, and it's there. So, and that isn't 18%. It's only like the session tracking, like usage tracking, that's 18%. All the like sales data and the App Store view stuff, that's 100%.
Okay.
It's very useful information, and we all will have it as soon as everybody gets into the beta, or when it comes out of beta, everybody's going to have it. And so super useful. It's not yet a replacement for Flurry, in my opinion, but you know, it doesn't need to be. You can use both.
Okay, cool. So there was a couple of other things that I wanted to talk to you about, but I am conscious of time. Microsoft had their build conference last week and made some interesting announcements for iOS and Android developers, in that they are providing tooling within Visual Studio to be able to import your Objective-C or Android/Java projects and compile them for Windows Universal Apps, which I think means it'll run on any of the Windows platforms, not just their mobile phones. I know you've not had any hands-on experience with that yet, and neither have I, so I did want to mention that we were aware of that in case anybody was expecting us to talk about that, and we will come back to that once we've had some hands-on. But the other thing, obviously, that I did want to touch on you before we bring Nick into the conversation was, I know your watch arrived shortly after we recorded the last episode, my watch arrived this week. So I just wanted to get like your first impressions now you've been... I assume you've been wearing it every day since you got it.
Yeah, I really like it. As I've mentioned before, I was wearing a Microsoft Band for about 6 months, and that was cool, and I liked getting my text messages on my wrist when I was driving and all that, but the experience with the Apple Watch is much, much better. I love the fitness tracking stuff. The heart rate is really, really accurate, which I couldn't say about the Microsoft Band. And the readout that you get when you go into the workout app is great. Like, so if you're, I go on bike rides, and so it can tell me how fast I'm going, or it can tell me how far, or it can tell me what my heart rate is currently. So I love that. Apple Pay on it is really nice. Surprisingly, you would think, you know, how much harder is it to pull out your phone, but then how much harder is it to pull out your credit card? Not that much, but for whatever reason, it feels amazing to just be able to swipe your wrist. You know, you push the button a couple times and then swipe your wrist across the reader and stuff's paid for. That's awesome. So I'm really happy with it. How about you, Mick? What do you think?
Yeah, so, I mean, I was impressed from the off, to be honest, because I think the packaging that it comes in is really does it justice, like that really long, heavy. Because, I mean, that's the first thing that I noticed when the delivery chap passed me the box, was how heavy it was for what I knew was just the watch. But all that weight is in the plastic case that the watch is actually in when you get it.
And it's gigantic and it's heavy, yeah.
But it's nice, though. It's quality, though.
Yes.
And then, so, set up, first charge, first pair, all went smoothly. Didn't have any of these problems that I've seen people talking about on Twitter. And I have been really impressed with it. I love the screen. So, I was wearing a Pebble. And then, a few weeks ago, I went from a Pebble to the Moto 360, which was a vast improvement.
Is that Moto a bigger watch face than the Apple Watch?
Only slightly. So what I did when I got a watch, I put a photo in our Slack channel of all three watches side by side, because I know some people were still debating between the 38mm and the 42mm. And the Pebble's definitely the biggest, then the Moto 360, and then I've got the 42mm, but it's still the smaller of those three watches. But the screen on the Moto 360 is nowhere, you can't even compare the two, like the Apple Watch and the 360. The Apple Watch is just leaps ahead. So and I think it's really like the clarity of the screen, and then it's as sensitive as the iPhone, which I was really impressed about, because again, the 360, you like really have to drag your finger around to get any sort of response, like the early days of touchscreens and mobile phones, whereas the one on the Apple Watch is very, very like, or as sensitive as the iPhone. So I was really impressed by that, and I've not had any problems with battery life as well. My battery seems to be holding up pretty well.
Yeah, that's a good point. I was surprised. There was a lot of concern about battery life, but most I charge mine at night, and most of the days when I've got a charged watch in the morning, I've got still at least 50% on it at the end of the day. So like, I'm nowhere near concerned at this point. It seems like that was all just kind of you know, a lot of panic over nothing.
Yeah, I think so. And I've not noticed. I know a lot of people complaining, saying like app launch time is ridiculously long, and they get that little spinner for what can be up to a minute. You know, I've not seen any of that. Mm-hmm. I have tried out quite a few apps.
I have seen that on a couple of different, always on third-party apps, and not every time, and not on the same app every time, but I have had it where it's like, it starts, and then it spins, and then the watch shuts off, you know, the screen goes off, and then you tap it, and then, like, by the time it comes up, you've, like, moved on with your life. So I have seen that.
Oh, okay. Well, one of the other things that I noticed as well between the 360 and the Apple Watch is the distance that you can travel before it disconnects is a lot longer on the Apple Watch.
Like how much longer?
Well, I mean, obviously you can't see how big my house is, but I quite often leave the Android phone upstairs. And if I went downstairs into the kitchen, like, it would come up with a little disconnected sign and it would say offline. So, I mean, that's not a long distance at all.
Okay. But it's like a floor plus something.
Yeah. It's just a few feet, really. Like, if you put it out in a straight line, it'd be just a few feet. But the Apple Watch, I've not had it disconnect yet. And that seems to be more in line with the Pebble. Like, I never had any problems with connection on the Pebble. But I can't say whether that's the hardware in the watch or the hardware in the phone for that disconnection problem. Because I'm pairing it with a Moto G, so it could be sort of a poor radio in the Moto G, or it could be a poor radio in the 360. I'm not sure which one that is. But I think this is probably a good point now to... It's not so much a good segue, but I think it's a good point to bring Nick into the conversation. Welcome, Nick.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
No problem.
So before we get onto the topic of this episode, which is React Native, and I know you're eager to tell us all about that, I wanted first for you to tell us a bit about who you are and how you first got involved in iOS development.
Okay, so my name's Nick Lockwood. I'm an iOS developer. I have been since about 2009. Prior to that, I was a front-end web developer. Working for a digital agency in London. I'd always kind of been interested in Apple software development, but hadn't really done anything with it. And, you know, we had a client who wanted an iPhone app, which was kind of like this new crazy thing that people were building. And that's how I got into it. Since then, I've worked on a bunch of different commercial projects. I've also got a few open source libraries that people may have seen. And I wrote a book on core animation back in 2012, I think it was. But I currently work at Facebook in London, and I've been the lead iOS engineer on React Native since January.
So you touched on it there that you've got some open source, but I think that's a bit of an understatement, because if you look at your GitHub account, there's many, many open source repos there.
And like one, two, 50, yeah. You know, something like that.
And so, I mean, some of it is pretty amazing stuff. I mean, I've used a lot of it personally. So in the first app that I ever released on the store, I used iCarousel. So I was wondering where that, like, that willingness to open up your projects comes from.
I think it sort of predates, like, you know, being an iOS developer. I mean, basically, I started open sourcing stuff because I had, like, a huge folder of abandoned projects on my hard disk. And, like, I'd start all these things and I'd have all these big ideas for them. And then, you know, I'd get them to sort of the 80% complete mark, and then I'd move on to something else. And, you know, a few months later, I'd forget how it worked and it wouldn't compile anymore. And then it was effectively gone. Like, I still had the source code, but it was useless. So I felt like releasing things, like open sourcing things, was quite a good way just to force me to get things to a minimum viable product where, like, it had enough documentation and, you know, actually sort of compiled when you downloaded it rather than needing a bit of tweaking. So that, like, maybe there was a chance that if I ever did want to use it again, it would still work. So it was kind of, yeah, it was more for my own benefit. There wasn't really much of an altruistic motive here. It was just like, I kind of want to make sure that I leave all of my projects in a working state. I didn't really think about sort of, like, you know, the other benefits, like self-promotion and, you know, people contributing bug fixes and features and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, that came later, but initially I was just literally doing it because, you know, it was a good place to put stuff so that it would kind of keep working, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. Now, just before we get on to React Native, I do have one more question. And it's the inevitable, did you buy an Apple Watch question?
No, I didn't. I do own a Pebble, which I think I haven't worn in about a year. I don't know. I was really excited when I saw the Apple Watch announcement. Like, I was going to get one, and then they announced the pricing, which was kind of like, oh, right, so I can get, like, the cheapest one, which I don't think looks that great, or I can spend a silly amount of money, which doesn't seem like a very good idea. And I don't know, I don't think that was the only thing that put me off. Like, once I saw how limited the sort of the API is for it, I just can't, like, I can't really, there's no app I'm excited to build for it right now. Like, there's nothing that makes me think, hey, I really need to get my hands on one of these and start coding for it. So, I mean, maybe like in like the 1.1 or 2.0 version of the API, they'll add something really cool, and then I'll be excited about it. But for now, I can live without it, which is a weird sensation for me, because like I pretty much own all the Apple products. you know, I've bought every iPhone except the first one, actually. So maybe it's the same kind of situation. I didn't buy the first iPhone because it didn't really seem like a very cool thing for a developer. Maybe I'll buy the second Apple Watch. We'll see.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair point. And I know Jake and I have discussed that. We both went for the Sport because you're not going to spend... Like, I would have preferred just to get, like, the stainless steel one with the Link bracelet. But I'm not going to spend upwards of £1,000 on a first generation limited device. You know, like, I'll wait until second or third device. And then, you know what it is that you're buying. Obviously, there's a lot of unknown when they released the Apple Watch. Even for developers, because they'd only ever used the simulator. So, no, totally understand where you're coming from with that. So, let's talk about React Native, which was the whole reason we got you on. and we've kind of got there finally in a roundabout way. So, the first question that obviously I wanted to ask is what React Native is. But I think for this particular topic, it's worth going a step back, because React Native is actually based on something called React. So I think a better place to start would be for you to tell us what React is and then lead into React Native.
Right, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So React is, it's Facebook's most popular ever open source library. It has like 21,000 stars on GitHub, which is even more than 320 had before they deleted it. And, you know, it's if you're a web developer, you will have heard of this. Like, it's a huge thing in the web development community, and it's pretty much completely unknown to iOS developers, I would guess. Basically, what it is, it's a JavaScript library for building web applications, which, I mean, there's a lot of these things. So that doesn't make it unique in any way. It's been successful because it simplifies how you create very complicated applications by using a functional declarative style instead of the usual sort of mutable tree of views approach. So it's designed for the web, so it outputs HTML basically. React Native takes the sort of the same front end that React has, which is this kind of JavaScript engine for producing views, but it replaces the HTML backend with native iOS views instead.
I think a lot of people, when they hear that it's a JavaScript framework, are going to immediately think of PhoneGap or Appcelerator Titanium, but it's not the same thing at all. Can you kind of explain the difference? Are you familiar with... I'm sure you're familiar with PhoneGap, but...
Oh, yeah, totally. Or Cordova, as it's sometimes called for some reason. Yeah, so it is different from both of those. So PhoneGap is basically a system for... like putting HTML on the screen. You know, a PhoneGap application is effectively a full screen web view. It's different from that because we don't have HTML in React, like in React Native. It's not about sort of HTML and CSS and you know, putting your web application on your phone. That's not how it works at all. Titanium is a little bit more like the way that React Native works. So Titanium uses JavaScript to put native views on the screen, basically. So they have something that's a bit like HTML and something that's a bit like CSS, and you use that to kind of design your layout, and then it generates native views behind the scenes. And that's kind of like what we're doing. The reason that React works better is because it has this sort of declarative interface. So with React, the data only flows in one direction from sort of the top down, whereas with Titanium, it's kind of the traditional view model where, you know, you've got a bunch of different views that are all sending messages to each other and mutating each other's state and so on. And as your application grows, it becomes very complicated and difficult to manage. The idea of React Native is it kind of avoids that problem.
So can you just give us an overview of the sort of architecture then of, you know, what's going on? If I'm writing this app in JavaScript, like, but you're putting native views on the screen, how is getting from one to the other?
The application that you write in React Native is a JavaScript application. All of your kind of custom code, well, most of your custom code will be JavaScript. What happens is we have something called the bridge, which is basically this native interface between JavaScript and the UIKit backend. React does its thing in the front and then serializes a bunch of data and sends it over the bridge. And then that's turned into native views on the other side.
And this is making use of JavaScript core, is that right?
It is, yeah. So we actually have multiple different implementations. For debugging purposes, JavaScript, like running stuff in JavaScript core, well, this is kind of like one of the fundamental problems with PhoneGap and other similar things, is that it's kind of difficult to debug the app because what's happening inside the phone in like a web view or inside JavaScript is fairly opaque. You can't put a breakpoint in Xcode and, you know, stop on a line of JavaScript code. It doesn't work that way. When, you know, when we build an app and deploy it to the App Store, we'll be running in JavaScript core. But when you're actually developing, you have this option to run your JavaScript in a web browser, which means you can use the browser debugging tools. So Chrome has some very good debugging tools that let you set breakpoints and pause, you know, your JavaScript application as it's running. And if you do that with a React Native application, it will actually pause the native app that's running on the simulator or on your device. And, you know, you can then sort of inspect the state of your app and single step and so on.
As a native iOS developer and not a web developer, that blew my... In researching this, I heard that and it blew my mind. How for other native developers that aren't web developers, what does that give them in terms of the debugging tools? What does that look like when you're debugging and it's using like Chrome as its backend?
Well, I mean, it looks the same as, you know, developing a web application, but it's not really that dissimilar from developing a native app either. So, you know, when you're developing in Xcode, you can put a breakpoint in your code. When it gets there, it will stop, and you can look at sort of the state of all of your variables and so on. And, you know, you can use stuff like the Xcode view inspector to kind of look at your view hierarchy and see what's going on there as well. Web developers have very similar tools built into the browser, so it's not always on by default, but like there's usually a develop menu where you can turn this stuff on. And that lets you do things like inspect elements on the screen and see what their properties are and, you know, find the JavaScript files and put breakpoints in there and have the JavaScript execution stop when it reaches that breakpoint, and then you can single step and do all of this kind of thing. The web development tool set is not really a different language from the native development tool set in that regard. I guess what's odd about React Native is that you're using the web development tools to develop a native app. So you'll be switching between Xcode and Chrome probably. You know, if you want to put a breakpoint in your JavaScript code, you do that in Chrome. But if you want to inspect the native view hierarchy, you do that in Xcode.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and talk about our sponsor and thank them this week for sponsoring the podcast. Wired In is letting others know when you need to be left alone. Your friends and coworkers don't mean to interrupt you while you're in the zone. They just have no way to know that you're in the middle of something that requires complete concentration. Your Wired In sign is going to change that. Your Wired In sign comes with a beautiful rounded aluminum base, bright adjustable LEDs, and an interchangeable custom laser-etched acrylic with your favorite saying that lights up when you're busy. Wired In was built for the way you work by a team of engineers, writers, and designers. The iOS, OS X, and Apple Watch apps give easy access to control your sign via keyboard shortcuts, simple gestures, IFTTT integrations, or even Siri. Whether you're a writer in the zone, or a podcaster on air, or a developer, Wired In, your sign will let others know you're busy so you can get things done. Wired In is available for pre-order on Kickstarter in both individual and team packages. It works really well for individuals looking to increase their focus and is perfect for a manager that wants to help the productivity of their team. Get your team Wired In. Pre-order your signs today. Thanks again to Wired In for sponsoring this episode of the Ray Wenderlich Podcast. I know these guys at Wired In. One of the engineers, a good personal friend of mine, and so I've got a prototype, and they're really nice-looking signs. Check out the Kickstarter.
So, Nick, one of the things researching React Native that I think was different to, well, at least my experience with the likes of PhoneGap / Cordova and Accelerator, was that with those two, you're kind of locked in to what they give you, but React Native is extensible, which is obviously great because developers tend to build their own libraries and UI components a lot. So how do developers go about exposing that custom code for use in React Native?
We have a plugin system, which is Cordova, actually. PhoneGap also has a similar system where you can basically build native classes and then, you know, use special syntax or particular commands to expose that to JavaScript so it can be called. what we've tried to do is like, you know, when I joined the project as a native developer, one of the things I was very keen on was that it should be as easy as possible for native developers to, you know, reuse their code in this, because up until that point, I think the focus had mainly been on web developers. When we see a problem, we think, okay, well, I'll solve that by writing some native code. When a web developer sees it, they think, I'll solve that by writing JavaScript. And you can do both with React Native. You know, I wanted to make sure that, like, if you already had, like, cool custom views like iCarousel or something like that, it would be possible to use them. What we basically have is we make sort of heavy use of macros to basically, when you write a plugin, you can wrap the methods of your plugin in these macros that basically make them available to JavaScript. They help handle the conversion of parameters. So, like, if you're, you know, if you want an image, for example, on the native side, on the JavaScript side, you just send a string, which would be like the name of the image, and the framework will know that is supposed to be an image, and will try and find an image whose name matches that, so that you're not sort of having to do all of that conversion work yourself manually. So we have two kinds of plugin at the moment, and they're all sort of called like bridge modules. That's kind of like our collective term for native plugins for React. You've got sort of modules that aren't really concerned with view stuff. So like you could have, I don't know, something that monitors your location, like geolocation, and periodically updates JavaScript with that information so that you can do something with a map or whatever. And then you have view plugins, which let you expose native views to React so that they can be used in your view layouts. And the plugins for those are kind of like controllers. We call them view managers. They're basically a sort of factory that creates instances of the view, which can then be used.
Okay, great. So React Native was originally kind of teased at the React JS Conf at the end of January, and then was finally released to the public at the end of March. One of the features that a big deal was made of back then and since its release was the live reload, and the lack of need to sort of stop the app, you know, recompile everything in Xcode and then run it again. So can you sort of explain what exactly live reload is and why that's such a big advantage over to the sort of the standard way of iOS developing?
So one of the big problems we have at Facebook is we have like some pretty huge apps. I mean, the Facebook app itself is a huge app, and it takes a really, really long time to compile. You know, if you're swapping between different projects or something, that's really frustrating. Like, you know, you can sort of think, okay, well, I need to work on the main app, so I'll set it going, and then I'll like go and have a cup of coffee and come back, and it's still compiling, and you know, this is really affecting my productivity. I think one of the sort of most exciting things about the React Native idea is that because essentially all of your custom application logic is running in JavaScript, you know, to completely rerun your app, all you have to do is just rerun the JavaScript and it's interpreted, so it doesn't really need to be compiled. And that's almost instant, even if your app is very large and complicated. When you're developing a React Native app, sort of when you're running in debug mode, the way it works is you have a node server that's running on your Mac, and it serves up the JavaScript file for the app via a localhost URL, which the app connects to. And you can reload your app at any time in the simulator by pressing Command R. That's Command R in the simulator, not in Xcode. And that will just re-request the latest version of the JavaScript and kind of reset everything in the app so that it like sets it back to a clean state. And because that doesn't need to recompile any of the native code, so that's essentially instantaneous. It just needs to connect to a localhost URL again and, you know, reset the app to its initial state. We also have something called Live Reload, which is basically we run a service called Watchman on the Mac, which looks at all of the JS files. So when you're developing, you actually have multiple JavaScript files, and there's a packager which combines those all into a single file, which is what gets served up by the URL. So Watchman will look at all of the individual files that are used, you know, all the individual source files that are used to make your application. And if any of them change, it will just automatically, you know, recompile the JavaScript file and refresh the app, so you don't have to do anything at all. And that's pretty cool. Like, so you can just go and type a change in one of your files, and you should see the result instantly on screen. I mean, it will reset the app, so it's not quite like the sort of playground thing. I mean, maybe one day, but we're not quite there yet. It certainly makes, you know, the sort of the cycle of make a small change, you know, see if that's done what you wanted, make another change, see if that's done what you wanted. It makes that much, much quicker because there's no recompilation step in between.
Yeah, I mean, I loved when watching the video, that I can't remember the chap's name that was doing the presentation, but he referred to it as developer velocity, which I think is a great term. So we've got a really in-depth tutorial on the site written by Colin Eberhardt, and we put this out sort of the day that React Native was released to the wild. So I've as part of the research for this episode, Jake and I have both worked through that. I couldn't actually get the command R thing working in the simulator. But if I did, because it's the alternate one, isn't it, where you can bring up the menu where it gives you all the options. Is it Control Command Z? And then you can hit the live reload button there, and it did do the refresh. But I couldn't get the command R working. So I don't know whether that was an issue with what I was doing or if that was something broken in the latest version.
Oh, that's interesting. I don't know. I mean, we're constantly pushing new versions to GitHub, so it's possible you just got a bad build there. Works on my machine. So we have a debug menu in the app. You can actually use Command D or Control Shift Z, which is basically the shake gesture, which we've just put in, so you can use it on a real device if you're testing on a device where you don't have a keyboard. Keyboard shortcuts are kind of just a helpful thing to speed up your development. You can use the debug menu to reset the app instead, or you can just rerun it from Xcode. I mean, that works equally well if you sort of rerun without recompiling.
So Nick, in its current form, is React Native for just iOS apps, or can you use it to build today extensions or even like watch extensions?
In its current form, it's just for iOS apps. Well, iOS and Android apps. We've got Android coming pretty soon, hopefully. In theory, like, there's no reason why you couldn't use it with WatchKit, I don't think. I mean, I've not looked into the WatchKit API a huge amount, so maybe I'm missing some obvious reason why that wouldn't work. But basically, you know, React generates a view hierarchy, which is kind of like an abstract virtual view hierarchy. You know, as long as whatever platform you're targeting has a similar concept, like as long as it needs to put stuff on the screen, you could in theory build a backend that would serve that platform. So yeah, I mean, I think we could support WatchKit. It's not something that we've planned to do. Maybe somebody, you know, some enterprising person out there will build a WatchKit backend. I think that would be pretty cool. But it's not something we've looked at doing yet.
I mean, that might be something that needs to wait for native. I mean, I know you said that you've not really looked into the WatchKit API, but everything in WatchKit has to be done in a storyboard. You can't actually like instantiate a view from code,
right?
And it all has to be loaded up front. So everything that you need to you're ever going to display in the entire life cycle of your WatchKit application needs to be in that storyboard, and then you literally go through and hide everything, and then you flick that switch to show it when you need it on screen.
Yeah, that probably wouldn't work then.
But maybe for native apps.
Right. Yeah. I think we would. Well, we'd either need native apps or we'd need some mechanism for like sending our own stuff down, you know, down that wireless connection to the watch. So whatever WatchKit is doing to serialize that storyboard, if there was a way of tying into that, it would work. But yeah, I mean, outputting a story, even if you could generate a storyboard programmatically by kind of reverse engineering the format, that's not really the idea. Like, you know, it's not a kind of build a storyboard and then build your app from that. That's not really how it would work.
So, I mean, one of the things, as I was working through the tutorial, and I've got all this stuff running, and you know, Colin does a great job of explaining the architecture and all these different pieces that work together, and the way that it, you know, it generates the view hierarchy, and then it does this diffing between, is it called the shadow DOM, which is what you build in the JavaScript, and then the actual view hierarchy, and it only changes where there's differences. And I was just wondering if there was like performance issues using React Native over just native.
So there are some performance implications. We're running in JavaScript, right? So you've got garbage collection and you've got this asynchronous connection between the JavaScript sort of execution context and the native code. And, you know, we're working to try and minimize that and make that connection as fast as possible. But it is a little bit of a bottleneck. The system that React uses, which I guess I didn't explain very well before, but basically... the idea is that whenever you make any change, so it's not exactly a stateless system, but state is, or your views are immutable in React. So if you wanted to change, like, let's just say you've got a big screen of stuff and you have a label somewhere and you want to change it, you re-render the whole screen, not just the label. You have this hierarchy of components, and each component has a render method, and the render method outputs kind of all of the subcomponents. You know, any component can update its children, but it can't change its siblings or its parent. So if you want to change something somewhere deep in the hierarchy from somewhere at the top of the hierarchy, you just re-render everything all the way down. And that sounds like it would be slow because you're redrawing a lot of stuff that you don't need to. But in practice, it's actually very fast, because what's really happening is that behind the scenes, React does a diff between, you know, the previous state of your view and the new state, and will only actually update the bits that have changed. With React Native, what happens is, like, you know, you re-render your whole view in JavaScript, and it works out that only a label has changed. And so all it sends, you know, via JSON to the native code is that one label, or just the text of that one label. So it's not a lot of data at all. And that actually makes it pretty fast. And that's kind of the whole benefit here. And this was why it was so successful on the web, because on the web, updating the HTML DOM is very slow. And React kind of avoids that problem by only updating the stuff you need to. So this is a kind of optimization we've never really seen on, you know, native apps before, where you get all of the benefits of not having to worry about, like, what's changed. You know, you can just, every time your data changes, you just refresh everything and don't have to think, oh, you know, might I have missed a view somewhere that's now going to have, like, the wrong state. But you don't have to pay the performance cost of doing that. The system makes sure that only the things that need to be updated are updated.
So we just have one last question for you. If somebody wants to get started with React Native, what would be your recommendation? Where should they go?
So if you go to reactjs.com, you'll find about a bunch of documentation there about the React library, a lot of which is applicable to React Native. And there's a link to the React Native page on GitHub from there, where you can go and get, like, the latest version of the code. You'll also find some good, like, videos about it on YouTube by some of the people who were involved, like Christopher Chadeau, who kind of, you know, masterminded the original idea. And if you happen to be at UIConf in Berlin next week, I'll be doing React Native workshop for iOS developers there. So you can pop in and learn a bit about it.
Fantastic. Now, I think that's a good a place as any to call it a day. So it's been great having you on, Nick. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. Now, before I put out my usual call for feedback, I just want to take a minute to thank Alex from 10 Kettles. If you remember at the beginning of the last episode, we sort of let everybody know we got all this new recording equipment and we were taking a different approach to how we were recording the episodes. And we were open to feedback on what the best ways were doing that. And Alex actually wrote a very detailed blog post on his site about how to improve the sound, and he used the previous episode as his example, and it goes through and he shows you all the different things that he's changing in the editing software to improve both Jake and I voice, which is really good, and we're going to apply that when Jake does the editing for this episode. So retrospectively you'll hear this, but hopefully you'll be hearing it in a much richer sound than it was recorded. So thanks again, Alex from 10 Kettles. And on that, as always, if you have got any feedback, then it's podcast@raywenderlich.com, and we do take everything to heart. And even though we've only just started season 4, it won't be long before we start thinking about season 5, because obviously we only do 10 episodes a season. So get that feedback in now. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode of the raywenderlich.com podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you all next time.
And that's a wrap. Thanks again, everybody, for listening to the raywenderlich.com podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. And don't forget to leave a rating on iTunes. See you next time.